Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. You are listening to Latin Waves. This is Sylvia Richardson. I'm privileged to be joined by Jorge Martí, Secretariat of Hands of Venezuela. Hola, Jorge. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, we are witnessing the elections in Brazil, and by many counts, many people are describing this as a move to fascism. How do you see the process taking place in Brazil right now?
Well, yes, certainly what's happening in Brazil is quite worrying because the far-right candidate Bolsonaro won the first round of the election, and he was quite close, actually, to winning outright. He got 49% of the votes in the first round, and today is the second round, and all the opinion polls are showing that Bolsonaro might win this second round. In fact, he's ahead in the opinion polls by 8 to 10 points. This is quite worrying because this is a very reactionary candidate who's made very incendiary statements about many different things. He's supported the military dictatorship in Brazil. He's said that he intends to wage a campaign against Venezuela. He said that he wants to banish the left-wingers from the political scene. He wants to throw Haddad in jail. And a few other things like that. So it is very worrying. I don't think that we are on the verge of fascism in Brazil. And in fact, he has a very weak position in the two chambers of the Brazilian parliament. But above all, once he starts implementing his economic program, which is a very right-wing economic program, which has not been featured in the election campaign, which includes the privatization of most state assets, the counter-reform of the pension system, and a whole number of other attacks on the workers' living conditions, I think there will be a big reaction. In the same way that Macri was elected in 2015 in Argentina, and he has already witnessed four general strikes against his policies of labor counter-reform, pensions counter-reform, the budget and everything. So I think that, yes, he is a dangerous candidate. He must be stopped by any means necessary. But at the same time, his likely election will provoke a sharpening of the class struggle. The Brazilian workers have not been defeated in any major battles recently. And Bolsonaro does not count on a strong, organized fascist party. I mean, his supporters are mainly scattered. And his party is quite weak. So I think that, yes, he is dangerous. We should be worried. And there should be a strong campaign against him. But this is not the end of Brazilian democracy, which in any case, for most people, democracy in Brazil doesn't mean much, really. The police is already carrying out extrajudicial executions in the poor neighborhoods, in the favelas of the big cities. The different governments, including the government of the Workers' Party, has used the military police against workers and youth protests. There's already quite a lot of repression going on. And I think that the idea of democracy versus fascism is not very attractive for many people in Brazil. If you tell them, oh, what we had was wonderful and now this is all going to go away, they will tell you probably, well, what we had was not that wonderful after all. There's been a massive increase of unemployment. The only way really to fight the danger of Bolsonaro is by putting forward a class struggle alternative to say, no, we don't want any more agreements with bourgeois parties, which is what the PT did in power. What we want is a consistent policy in favor of the working class and the poorest sections of society. And that means the expropriation of the wealthy, the rich, the landowners, the bankers, and the multinational corporations.
Impunity is the daughter of oblivion. When we forget what it is we want, what it is we set out to create, and where we've come from, it's really easy sometimes to be swayed by the waves of polarization. We see how in the States the election of Donald Trump came as a surprise to many. But for those struggling, it's almost a sign of the times when you don't have a candidate, you know, that you can trust. Hillary Clinton was not a candidate that people felt they could trust. And, you know, Bernie Sanders was denied by foul play. So it's not surprising that people will put their ballots in places that are unlikely to be in their best interest. And yet, somehow, this movement has also awoken the giant. Can we talk about that for a moment?
Yes. Even in Brazil, I mean, in the last few days, there have been big mobilizations against the danger of Bolsonaro in Sao Paulo, in Rio, in Salvador de Bahia. There were big rallies of tens of thousands against Bolsonaro, trying to stop Bolsonaro. But the problem is that, as you were saying, if you try to prevent the coming to power of a far-right candidate who presents himself as an alternative to the establishment, as an outsider, by standing against him, a candidate which is the crystallization of the establishment, like in the case of the United States, Hillary Clinton, then you will never be able to win. You will never be able to mobilize those layers who are sick and tired of the political game and not turning up at the ballot box anymore. And in Brazil, this is exactly what's happening. You know, in the first round, Haddad attempted to cover himself with the mantle of Lula, the historic leader of the Workers' Party. But in the second round, Lula disappeared from the election propaganda. Even the red, which is the red color red, which is the color of the Workers' Party, was removed and changed by the colors of the national flag. And the whole campaign of Haddad was one of moderation, of appealing to the bankers and businessmen, of appealing to the bourgeois parties to support him, of talking about the unity of all Democrats, which obviously includes all the bourgeois parties that moved against the PT and removed Dilma from power in 2016. That's not the kind of campaign that you can be successful with if you're fighting with a far-right populist and demagogue. And in Brazil, you saw a phenomenon whereby about 30% of the people abstained or spoiled their votes in the first round in a country where voting is compulsory. So that's quite a lot of people who are dissatisfied with the political system in general. They don't support any of the candidates because they can't see anyone expressing their views, expressing their aspirations. And many of those are people who probably in the past voted for the PT, for the Workers' Party, when they saw it as standing for fundamental change. And they're now disillusioned by the experience of the Workers' Party in power. And above all, the Workers' Party in power in the middle of a capitalist crisis, like the very severe crisis that Brazil has been going through. But in the United States, we saw that many people were saying the election of Trump means the end of democracy, the beginning of fascism. And we're now here, say 2-3 years ago after, 2 years afterwards. And in reality, Trump has implemented many reactionary policies against migrants, against Muslims, against workers in general, reactionary policies at home and abroad. But at the same time, we don't have fascism in the United States. When the far-right white supremacist organizations attempted to organize on the back of Trump winning power, there were a few skirmishes in Charlottesville and in other places, but then they were immediately shut down by big mobilizations in Boston, in San Francisco, and in other places. And they're not as well organized as they could have been. And at the same time, we have seen a wave of class struggle, for instance, very militant, rank-and-file-led teachers' strikes in a whole number of different states, in Wisconsin, in Washington, and is now spreading to many different places, the struggle of the McDonald's workers, $15 an hour wage, and a whole number of other struggles that reaction against this rise of far-right populism. And I think that we will see the same kind of thing in Brazil if Bolsonaro finally wins the election today.
Whether he wins or whether, you know, the left party wins, I think that we are witnessing a renaissance of in the labor struggle of people coming together and realizing that we cannot simply elect someone and hope that they'll do what is required. We need to have a plan for movement ahead, for creating what we want. Here I think we can use perhaps the example of Venezuela, where they are now surrounded by right-wing governments, where only a decade ago he was Venezuela was surrounded by allies. What can we learn from what has happened in Venezuela?
I think that the main lesson is that you cannot make half a revolution. When Chavez came to power, and it's coming to 20 years now in December when he first won the 98 presidential election, he had a program of reforms, and then he started talking about socialism around 2004-2005. And he did carry out many reforms, which are still in place in Venezuela in terms of access to education, access to housing, access to healthcare. And many of these things are still in place in Venezuela today. But the problem is that though he talked about workers' control and encouraged workers' control, he talked about socialism, he talked about destroying the capitalist, the bourgeois state, but many of these things were left as words. They were never actually implemented. And in his last speeches, he was very bitterly complaining about this. He said, look, we've been talking about socialism, but the economy is still capitalist. We've been talking about a communal state, but the state is still a bourgeois state. And in fact, since he died in 2013, the situation has changed for the worst. The government has implemented a policy of concessions to the capitalists, of concessions to foreign capital, in this case, Chinese, Russian, Turkish foreign capital. And this combined with obviously an increased imperialist intervention and assault, the blockade, economic war and so on has led to a disastrous situation for the Venezuelan economy. So I will say the main lesson is you cannot leave things halfway. If you carry out a revolution, you have to carry out until the end. You cannot regulate capitalism, which is what they attempted to do in Venezuela, because regulating capitalism leaves you with the worst of both worlds. You do not have a planned economy in the benefits of the majority, but also you don't have a functioning capitalist economy anymore because of all the regulations and state intervention, which creates a reaction on the part of big business. I will say that's the main lesson. And that's also the lesson in the other countries, in Brazil, in Argentina. There were governments that claimed to be progressive governments, but never really challenged the foundations of the capitalist system. And then eventually, when the economic crisis came, mainly driven by the collapse in the price of raw materials, then they were removed from power. And that experiment, the attempt to tinker with capitalism, to regulate it somehow, to make it work for the majority of the people, failed. And I would say this is the main lesson.
In the case of Venezuela, though, we can argue that not only were they challenged by the task of changing their society by first educating their people and creating health and, you know, all the necessaries of life, but on top of that, the government was also challenged with economic and political interference, foreign trade and financial embargo. I mean, there's a lot of threats that they have been fending off. So in a way, I think that it's important to recognize that perhaps it's not a lack of trying that we make mistakes such as the concessions that the Maduro government has made, but it's perhaps a way of surviving politically.
Yeah, yes, you could say that. But I mean, in any case, any left-wing government that comes to power and attempts to stick to its program will come under sabotage of the ruling class. We saw that with the Allende government in 1971-73 in Chile, the Arbenz government in 1953 in Guatemala, and so many other governments. This you take for granted. And in Venezuela, there has been a lot of that. In 2002, there was the coup against Chavez, which was supported by big business and also by the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. administration, the Spanish government. Then in 2005, there was a recall referendum. There's been several attempts to orchestrate coup plots, attempts on the life of the president, economic sabotage, and more recently, starting with Obama in 2015, the economic sanctions, which have really crippled the ability of the Venezuelan economy to negotiate its foreign debt and get financing for its projects and so on. And this in the context of an economic crisis. This is all true. But I will say that the problem is that the Venezuelans are fighting against this economic war, as they describe it themselves, with one hand tied to their backs. I'll just give you one example. In August, on the 19th of August, Maduro implemented a new program of economic reconstruction. And part of this program was an agreement with big business about the agreed prices for a whole number of basic food products so that people could afford them. And this was combined with a big increase in the minimum wage. Now it's 3 months since then, two full months from August to September, September to October. And this agreement has already been broken by private business. But this was completely foreseeable. Big business has broken every single agreement it has reached with the Venezuelan government ever since 2002. So you can't say that the government didn't know. I mean, if you want to guarantee production for the people, then you have to take over private business and use the productive capacity and the workers' control in order to produce for the needs of the people and not for profit. As long as there is production for profit, there will be speculation, there will be hyperinflation, there will be black marketeering. So you have to wonder whether the government is naive or the government is also, elements within the government are also in cahoots with private business and they're benefiting from this situation, because this is not the first time. I mean, you can make a mistake one time. You can carry out a wrong policy with good intentions one time, two times, three times. But when this policy has consistently failed for the last 15 or 20 years, then if you continue to carry out the same policy, I don't know, perhaps you don't see any other alternative. But carrying out a policy that has consistently failed is criminal, and it also continues to undermine the support for the Bolivarian Revolution and paves the ground for the victory of the right wing in one way or another.
I think there is a learning process with every, you know, revolutionary process. And one of the things you point out is that you can't do half a revolution. You have to have a clear program. So how would you describe that clear program then in the case of Venezuela?
What I will say is that Venezuela has had its own learning process. At the beginning, President Chavez, when he came to power, he himself said that he adhered to the third way, explained by Tony Blair, a way which was not socialist and not communist and not capitalist. So some alternative in between. Progressively, he realized that this was not possible. And around 2005, he said the only way forward is socialism. As I said before, most of that was left in the field of words. It was never actually implemented. Now, today, there are many discussions going on in Venezuela about what is the lesson of all of this. Like yesterday, there was a big forum taking place in a working class neighborhood in Caracas to discuss what economic policies are necessary. There is a process of discussion amongst the peasants, amongst the workers who have now been fighting for the wages and for living wages and so on, about what is the way forward. There is a big debate now, for instance, in Venezuela. Some sections of the government say that the task is to create a revolutionary bourgeoisie. And many people say that this is not correct, it's not possible, and it's a completely wrong approach. So these discussions are taking place. And I will say that the most important thing from all of these experiences is to learn the main lessons. The lesson that you cannot try to regulate capitalism. You cannot, as you say, make half a revolution. you have to go all the way. You cannot have a hybrid between capitalism and socialism. That's the worst possible thing that you can have. What has failed in Venezuela is not socialism. Socialism was never actually implemented. What has failed was the attempt to have a halfway house to make capitalism work for the majority. And we need to learn this lesson. We need to discuss this experience in order to arm ourselves for the next battles that are coming up.
We keep repeating a process of electing people because we're not informed, because we're not taking time to learn what has gone before us, and those lessons that maybe left wounds, you know, imprinted on us, whether it's lessons of dictatorships, lessons of political embargoes and economic embargoes that leave the population without the basic essentials. All of those are lessons, and unless we pay attention, unless we are organized and collectively helping one another, we are bound to repeat them. So what inspires you that not only can we learn from our past, but we can also create a new path forward?
Yes, this is absolutely correct. I mean, the leader of the Russian Revolution 100 years ago, Vladimir Lenin, he said that without revolutionary theory, there is no revolutionary practice, or rather, there is no successful revolutionary practice. It's not the case that every generation should learn at their own cost the lessons from the mistakes that we have made in the past. There have been many revolutions throughout history, the Russian Revolution 100 years ago, the German Revolution now 100 years ago, the Spanish Revolution in the 1930s, the experience of the Allende government in the 1970s. All this already give us a body of theory, of experience, that should serve to arm ourselves for the present struggles. 100 years ago, the situation seemed very bleak, despite the fact that the socialist parties had promised to oppose the imperialist war. When the imperialist war started in 1914, they all supported their own ruling classes, with very few exceptions. The Social Democratic Party in Germany voted for the war credits. Same thing in France, in Italy, in all the belligerent countries. Socialist movement supported the ruling class, sending workers to kill other workers in the battlefields. And the situation seemed very bleak. At one point, there was a conference of internationalist socialists in Zimmerwald in 1915, and they were a small minority. Lenin jokingly commented that all the internationalists in the world could fit into coaches. And nevertheless, two or three years later, a revolution broke out in Russia. Revolution broke out in Germany 100 years ago in November 1918, and that put an end to the First World War. So from war and carnage came revolution. Now the situation now is not by far as bad as it was during the First World War. But we see the danger of far-right formations, right-wing populism, and so on. But this is also creating a reaction on the other side. The polarization to the right has an equal and opposite reaction as a polarization to the left. This, for instance, in the United States, there's never been more people looking for socialist alternative for many generations. An organization like the Democratic Socialists of America has gone from a few thousand to tens of thousands of members. The idea of socialism is now so popular that just last week, the White House produced a 74-page report denouncing socialism. This is unheard of. And socialism, which 25 years ago was supposed to be dead and buried, and Francis Fukuyama famously talked about the end of history, capitalism was the only possible system. Now socialism is again in the political discourse, in the discussions of hundreds, tens of thousands, millions of people are looking for an alternative to the left. So that's why I think we should be hopeful. We are hopeful, but the precondition for this is that these unconscious stirrings, this movement is groping towards socialist ideas, must be accompanied by a learning of the theory, learning of the mistakes of past movements.
Can we talk about the power of collective action? Because I think that alone is easy to feel afraid, but when we act collectively, our power not only increases personally, but our collective power to create change exponentially increases.
That's true. I mean, I think there is a very good current example of this, and this is that of the migrant caravan that's traveling from Honduras to the United States. Now, many of these people are fleeing violence, political persecution, poverty, which has been caused in Honduras, amongst other things, by the coup in 2009, which was fully supported by Hillary Clinton at the time. And these people were fleeing their countries in Central America and attempting to reach the United States before this migrant caravan this time. But they were doing it individually or in small groups. And now they've started as a collective action, started with a few hundred people organizing themselves and deciding to march north. And now it's thousands in two or three different caravans going from Guatemala, Costa Rica, from Nicaragua, from Honduras. They've arrived at the border in Mexico, and by the sheer strength of their numbers, they managed to cross the border, something that was unheard of before. And now they are crossing Mexico, creating a wave of mobilization on the wake. People are getting organized to give them food, to house them, to give them shoes and clothing, and to help them in their way to the north. And this has already created a political earthquake in the countries they left, in Mexico itself, and also in the United States, where President Trump has threatened to send the army to the border to stop them. So this has already created a massive movement, not just because they are migrants. There have been hundreds, thousands, millions of migrants before, but this time they've taken collective action as a group, as an organized force, and they've managed to achieve things that in the past might have seemed impossible. And this is just the beginning of this process. They're now moving north. They still have to arrive in the capital, in Mexico City. They've already rejected attempts to stop them in and settle them in Mexico. They want to move to the United States. And we'll see what happens. But I mean, this is much more powerful than the same number of migrants moving individually along the same route.
Thank you so much for being with us today. How can people access your work, and how can people stay in touch?
Yes, I will encourage everyone to look up the site that I'm participating in, which is called In Defense of Marxism, www.marxist.com.
Thank you again for being with us. Take care.
It's a pleasure. Thank you to you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.